Hello, welcome to Convergently Speaking. Today on the show, Gary Guilfoy joins Dan to talk about archetypes.
Well, Gary, welcome to Convergently Speaking. Really excited to have you on. You've been someone that I had in the back of my mind to bring on, and here we are getting together. So I've known you now for, 4 or 5 years or so. Came across each other through men's work and then sort of cross-pollinate. I see you nodding. Yeah, I think I came to the men's group you're involved in running. And then we connected through other mutual friends, and then you were lecturing where I was studying and so on and so forth. Adelaide's a small place, but
it is.
Maybe we can start, just you give us a bit of a background on who you are, what you do, and because you're going to explain it better than me.
Yep. So I live up in the hills over above your head. And I have an accent people might notice, and it's Canadian. And I've been in Australia for the better part of 40 years. I give too much away there, don't I? And I didn't actually do my training in counseling until I was in my 40s, which was 20 years ago. I've always been really interested in understanding people. And I think, like many people, probably yourself included, I think that that comes from wanting to understand ourselves. I did a master's in counseling at UniSA, and immediately, despite my lack of experience, I must say, I was asked to lecture. And I also, at the time, I thought, you know, where am I going to find the confidence, really, to step into a new field where people's well-being is at stake? You know, you don't want to blunder in. And I asked myself, what is it that I feel I really know or can contribute? And my response was the midlife transition. I was, I think, 44 at the time. And so I cobbled together an 8-week group for people in midlife, and I got a full group right away for some reason, and that rolled on for years, actually, and I didn't need to promote it, so that was great. And I learned counseling skills as I went, skills I didn't learn in my training, it must be said. And at this time as well, I was teaching. I was learning a lot. You know, when you teach, you have to know what you're talking about. So I taught for 8 years at UniSA, and I overlapped with TAFE, and I taught for about 10 years, I think, for TAFE. And the last few years, up until last year, I was a sessional teacher with the Australian College of Applied Psychology. So I've learned a lot of other things along the way. So what we're going to focus on today is archetypes, I think. That came from one of the subjects that I did at UniSA as a student. It was a fantastic program, which doesn't exist anymore. But their subject on developmental themes included archetypes. So an archetypal developmental pathway. And anyway, it never left me.
When you say archetypes, maybe you can give us a bit of a...
So archetypes, I remember being very drawn to, you know, I was always interested in the classics. The first I understood of archetypes was through Plato. So Plato talked about archetypes, but Plato talked about archetypes as spiritual beings, and spiritual beings that resided in the realm of forms. And so in his mind, anything that took form, took material form on Earth, had its origins in archetypal form, in what we would call the invisible world. Now, I don't really know where that thread went. You know, I'm sure Plato was part of one of the mystery schools. They sort of faded out or became more obscure through the ages. But when archetypes reared its beautiful head again, it was through Carl Jung, who was also very interested in old cultures. But when Jung employed them, he did so in a psychological form. And so he, I don't know how much people might know, your listeners might know about Carl Jung, but he loved exploring old indigenous cultures. And what he saw, how he arrived at his understanding of archetypes, in all of these indigenous cultures, there were particular ways of being that they all had in common, although they were specific to their culture. And so I think probably the best way to think about that is that all cultures have what we would now call a warrior type of being. That's a warrior with an A. This is where my accent throws me off. People correct me sometimes. Yeah. So we talk about, so all of the schema, I think, around archetypes would include a warrior archetype. So all cultures have, you know, what do warriors, what are their psychological components? You know, they're focused, they're disciplined, they have courage, they want to win. So there are people who play those roles in traditional cultures, but they are qualities we all have in us as well. So Jung conceives of these archetypal structures living in the collective unconscious, and we rub up against them, and we embody their natures. They're actually, in fact, innate in us, and we can draw on them as circumstances necessitate in our lives.
As I'm listening, I'm thinking the question that the listeners are going to have, and one I have too, is what's the difference between archetypes and personality? Because I do talk a lot about Myers-Briggs, which is also based on Jung's work. So yeah, there's obviously similarities, but how do you define them differently?
So that's a very good question. And that's something that I make sure people understand if they're going to either come to a workshop or have a profile done. So this is not a typology thing. So with Myers-Briggs, you might be an ENTP, for example, and that doesn't make you an automaton, of course, but that's your personality type. So with the archetypes, they're more like, they are, in fact, energies that I can draw on, you can draw on according to circumstance. So, for example, let's talk about the warrior archetype. You might be coasting along. I mean, I should also introduce the developmental nature of the archetypes. In fact, I should probably do that first. It would make sense of other things.
All right.
So if a person were to go online and Google archetypes, they'd probably see a whole lot of people who work with 12 archetypes. There are lots of archetypes. There are archetypes for everything, really. But the 12 key psychological archetypes are pretty similar across the board, no matter who's working with them, although they might have different names. So, for example, if I mention the creator archetype, it's often called the visionary archetype.
Yeah, okay.
And so the archetypal journey, you could say, unfolds over time, so across the lifespan. And the first four, I'll talk about them specifically in a minute, but the first four lay the foundation of the personality and mostly are unfolded, have found their form by your 20s. And then the next four, which is called the journey stage, you know, take place up until the 40s, let's say. And then the last four, the return stage of the journey. Yeah, so in that sense, that's a similar journey to, for example, what Joseph Campbell might envisage. So the first pair of archetypes, the pairing of them is important because this continuum between the trust and mistrust of Erik Erikson, or the orphan and the innocent. Carol Pearson has the format that I follow most closely because it makes the most, it's the one I learned it, and it makes the most sense to me. And so, you know, if you think about innocent, you think of, you know, somebody who's born into an environment of love and safety and, you know, appreciation for who they are and so on. And they, you know, these people will form relationships very easily and want everybody to be happy. And it kind of sounds ideal in its extreme. They will see the world through rose-tinted glasses and be gullible and et cetera. And on the other side of that continuum is the orphan. And that's the part of us that, for whatever reason, is met with not everything's great. So you can think in terms of attachment theory. 60% of people, they say, are securely attached. That would probably describe the innocent quite effectively. And 40% of people are insecurely attached. And so those people, in fact, learn to look after themselves from a very early age. The orphan gets the message very early that if its needs are going to be taken care of, they're going to be by him or herself. So they become discerning. They observe things rather than leap in. They keep their distance. You know, they become free thinkers, really. The shortcoming of the orphan is that they create distance between themselves and other people. Now, both of those qualities, you won't have anyone that's purely one or the other, because when the innocent starts, you know, when it has a sibling or when it starts school, you know, then it's going to learn what life is really like, and it's going to have to build up its resilience. Mm. That resilience is a quality of the orphan. On the other hand, you know, if the orphan is very strong early on, those people are going to want to form relationships, and to form relationships, we need to be vulnerable. So they will find a level at some point over the coming years. If people are still, you know, holding on to a very tough orphan in their 20s and 30s, people will notice that. They're going to be thick-skinned and they're not going to let you in. So questions about that one?
No, but just to probably reiterate what you're saying is, because it was like a passing comment, but you said you like it because it doesn't pathologize. And so from what I'm hearing you say, it's like there's a continuum and we need to find a balance, and possibly we need to move between, would this be accurate? We need to move between that continuum. We don't stay stuck in the same place, depending on our life stage and circumstances and so on and so forth.
Yes. So there are times and places for the orphan, for example, or for the innocent. So, you know, I think with all interpersonal work, what we try to do in our therapeutic professions is to make things really clear so people are free to choose. Mm. So when I talk about balance, if we're going to be unconscious about the life we live, balance would be a nice way to do that. But otherwise, we want to be clear about, for example, that I have the possibility in me of being open to lowering my walls and connecting with people. I also have the possibility of putting my walls up if I feel I'm in an environment which is unsafe or a little whatever it might be. Yeah, so bringing about choice is what I think is important for us, not assuming how people should be. So the next pair of archetypes then are the warrior and the caregiver. So they're paired archetypes. And the warrior, as I said before, is the part of us that can really focus and accomplish things. It's a goal-oriented, courageous quality. You know, I think the word itself captures that quite well. Mm. And the caregiver, again, the other end of the continuum, is the compassionate nurturer, the caring person. They also describe traditional gender roles. You know, the warrior is a masculine force and the caregiver is a feminine force. And it's interesting, I find, to have been alive as long as I have now and to have gone through, for example, the women's lib movement of the 1960s and 70s. And because what women were asking for it to be all right in society, that they unfold their masculine natures. And women did that quite effectively, actually. And the male nature is actually much more structured. It's less flexible, less fluid, harder to soften up for the male. And I think that's what males are going through now.
Yeah.
And to get stuck in one or the other of those qualities, you know, too strongly masculine or too strongly feminine, can lead to imbalance. So, you know, and we see today people talk about toxic male culture. It's certainly very visible in our political system at the moment and also our corporate system. So if we're going to be very strong and clear and focused, we also want to do that with compassion and understanding for other people.
And I think yes. This touches into another Jungian idea, doesn't it? The idea that within us, we have both masculine and feminine, which is something I didn't realize was necessarily the mainstream or necessarily the accepted view. Like there's certainly people that would push back against that idea, but that's an idea that comes from Jung, that we, whether you're a man or a woman, you have both a feminine and a masculine essence.
Yes. So what I really like about Carl Jung's work, and I came to it late, I haven't done a proper training, it's just self-education. What I like is this notion of individuation. And that is a word that I think goes beyond Jungian circles these days. And what it actually means in essence is becoming whole, that we all have all of the human capacities within us, and that our natural trajectory in a Jungian framework is towards wholeness, and our struggles are with that intent of getting us there. So that's a great picture to hold for people. So if you have young people, for example, who are going through particular struggles, well, they're individuating, and we won't individuate without struggle, actually. So yes, I appreciate that very much. The other notion there that I'm sure you're familiar with doing relationship counseling as you do is these other key principles of anima and animus, you know, that we're also attracted to others that help make us whole. And that's an interesting thing when you think about archetypes. If I'm attracted to somebody who's just like me, we start colluding in our ways of being, and we can get really, well, we might be content, but we might not be growing. We might not be pushing ourselves to grow. So we often attract people who are unlike us. And if we can keep a mindset of, you know, that's because what that person has, I need more of in me. And unfortunately, I think those people also push our buttons because they're different from us, and we can polarize. We can start pushing them away. That happens too often too, as I'm sure you've noticed.
You must have just summed up 85% of the couples I see. Yeah. Yeah. Attracted. I mean, it's that's why we have a cliche, opposites attract. It's there in society because it's such a profoundly true thing.
Yeah. With couples, whether you're working with just one person who's having problems with their partner, or whether you have two people in the room, is to frame stuff like that, you know, to say, you know, what is it in her that you need in you? You know, the whole notion of wholeness and individuation, because we individuate through our entire lives. I think it's incumbent on us to conceptualize these things for our clients. I think, you know, I've started working more recently with complex PTSD, and the people who've really penetrated that, they do say the first two steps there are, number one, understanding what complex PTSD is. It's developmental PTSD that takes root very early and leaves us without personal agency for self-change. And so then the other key pillar at the beginning of working with that is developing a good relationship with a therapist who can take people through that. I find it amazing how I get very moved by people's stories. There are things that you know, have been just cliches to me over the years. And one of those things is mind-body connection. That's one of those things that I've heard a lot. And I kind of put it out there in left field, and I haven't asked what people mean by that. But with complex PTSD, so unlike what we understand about trauma or post-traumatic stress disorder, that means when that trauma gets re-triggered. We've always understood, or I've always understood, that there's an event that happens that we can't process. Our senses are overloaded. It doesn't make sense to us. We can't rationalize it away.
Yep.
Complex PTSD, on the other hand, it's also called developmental PTSD, is when we live in an environment for prolonged periods of time where we feel unsafe, whether we're being abused, whether we're being fearful or whatever. We become hypervigilant. We start living, really, this is my phraseology, we start living in our nerve sense system. We're hypervigilant to the environment around us. And we segment things. So I sit here, with people come and they tell me the most horrible stories of abuse. And I'm quite moved by those stories, often to tears. And they're telling them to me as if they've happened to somebody else. Because they haven't penetrated, they haven't been able to take a hold of their body and their emotional lives with what they know has happened to them. So that's what I now see as this, you know, the work of complex PTSD. It's not talk therapy. So this, you know, this is challenging for therapists who learn talk therapy. And so, you know, we talk about body work or somatic work, or internal family systems takes us on internal journeys and meeting the various fragmented and segmented parts of us. So, you know, we talk about dysregulation, and dysregulation is when we're not integrated between our thinking, our feeling, and our actions. So that's our job, to knit ourselves together again. It's challenging work. It's very fulfilling work. And there are people who have suffered for their whole lives. And in my practice, which is mostly men, I'm often the first person they've seen for help. So, you know, it's work you take very seriously.
It is, yes. I've had a number of men as well that have been, you know, so at the edge emotionally and everything because of the crisis in their relationship, that coming to see me is the first person they've seen as well. And yeah, you do. You take it seriously, especially for me when I see a couple book in and it's the man who's made the booking. Because that's not the norm, you know. No. It's not the wife dragging him in, but he's actually waking up and saying, "All right, I've got to take action."
Yes, they, you know, that it is in their relationships that they take the blows. Really, we all learn adaptive mechanisms. We all learn those things. I guess it's the severity of those things. So often people with CPTSD, one way they manage is to be very capable, you know, because as I think it was Gabor Mate says, he says, if I can't be wanted, then I must be needed, you know, which is a very powerful thing to say, but so many people operate out of that pretext that they're not wanted. And they can't register. You know, if we don't have the inner workings to register emotions, love or belonging or whatever it is, you can talk about it until you're blue in the face, but it's not going to register until you get into the body and the emotional life.
Yeah, 100%. And I wanted to go back to what you said earlier as well, because you made the comment that, you know, we tend to think of PTSD as being an event, and then went on to talk about how with complex PTSD, it's living week in, month out, year in, year out in an environment that feels unsafe. And I wanted to add in there, because I personally found this really eye-opening to start to understand that the really slippery thing about it is that it's not necessarily what happened, but what didn't happen often.
Yes.
So I read a book, highly recommend it, and maybe you've read it, Gary, Running on Empty, and it's all about emotional neglect. And, you know, the point they make in there is that, you know, if you had a mother or a father who physically beat you, or there wasn't food available for you to eat, it's quite easy to, as an adult, sit in therapy and know what what the trauma was, know what the issue was. Well, my dad would get drunk at the pub, he'd come home and he'd beat me. But for those that grew up in an emotionally neglectful household, it's more invisible. It's the,
yes,
we didn't get the question in the afternoon, how was your day? Or we didn't get a kiss and a hug before bed, or all these types of things.
Yes, they weren't nurtured to have any sense of self.
Mm.
Yeah, so it's a very rich field, and it's becoming very big now. One of the, I think it was Bessel van der Kolk, who wrote a fantastic book called Your Body Keeps the Score. He said the label or diagnosis of complex PTSD has not made it into the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistic Manual of Mental Health. I think it's fair enough to say yet, but it's a very thick book. And he said when complex PTSD makes it into the DSM, the DSM will be a much smaller book, because a lot of the diagnoses actually are accounted for by complex PTSD.
Sorry? Just for context, for those that don't know the DSM, it's in short, they call it the Bible of, you know, mental health disorders and categories that psychologists and other practitioners use.
Yeah. Even attachment theory, for example, will be subsumed by complex understanding complex PTSD.
Mm.
Yeah. If your listeners are interested in that, just get on YouTube and, you know, Google complex PTSD. It's a very rich field. And as you point out, Dan, I think it affects a lot more of us than we ever imagined. And I think it's probably best determined by your symptoms.
Mm.
How connected are you to your body? How connected are you to your emotional life? Yeah, what are your relationships like?
And on this topic, I've found Dr. Peter Levine's work to be just absolutely fantastic, along with Bessel van der Kolk, as you've mentioned, and we've mentioned Gabor. Fantastic on that front. So that's an interesting evolution for you then, from, you know, working with men in transition and using archetypes to now starting to hone in. Or I don't know if you're honing in, or if those people have come to you, and, you know, it's a bit of a chicken or the egg, it sounds like.
I do look to understand why we attract the people we attract at a particular time. So in my private practice at the moment, I have no less than 10 people with complex PTSD. So that's a very significant number. And, you know, one thing I can say is this true of me? And certainly to an extent it is, but, you know, I am in my mid-60s now, and I have done a lot over the years. So I've certainly softened some of the effects of what was a neglectful childhood. Yeah, and I think the other aspect that I said there, that people need to be informed, is the person of the counselor. And that is something that we learn in our training. And so one of the thoughts about complex PTSD is that when I talk about people are not granted this sense of self, that is the, you know, the element in us, if you will, the core part of us that orchestrates the whole of the personality. So it's, you know, you can talk about self with a capital S. It's a different principle than our psyche. If you equate psyche to soul, which is a very direct translation, actually, you can talk about the self perhaps as the spirit or the individuality of the person. And that's what's hiding away in people with complex PTSD. It hasn't felt safe enough to come out to visit. And, you know, in the interim, or when they start working on bringing the exile, is what it's called in internal family systems, bringing the exile out to integrate into the personality, you need to rely on somebody. You have to work with somebody who has a strong enough sense of self that yes. you can rely on. You need to really trust somebody yeah. in this work. And that is why, you know, I have had a long life now, and by this stage, you know, I'm pretty strong in myself. And so that's another thing I think that people actually can come to me and get what they need in terms of, you know, my strength of self as a helper in these situations.
Say a bit more yeah. about why that's so important.
Well, certainly in this context, as I said with the orphan previously, that they couldn't trust other people. So the orphan is one level, depending on how orphaned we, you know, I was an unwanted child, so I understand the orphan very well. Did my sense of self need to hide away? I had a lot of mechanisms at play to be wanted and loved and appreciated and all of those ploys in my early life. But by a certain age, people realize there's something amiss, you know, and sooner or later, our physical health also starts to degenerate. And the neuroscience that's evolving so rapidly at the moment shows why that's the case in trauma and complex trauma cases.
Pretty confronting, isn't it, when you look at just how much trauma impacts on the person's physical
Absolutely.
Health
physically
and length of life and all that, not just quality of life, which we know, but other things.
Yes. Yeah. It is the autoimmune system gets eroded by a continual release of cortisol. So when we're confronted, we all have a rush of adrenaline, and that should settle again very quickly after the threat is over. In people with trauma, the cortisol then keeps that going. So they live in this heightened sense of anxiety. And yes, that undermines the autoimmune system. So physically, Gabor Mate is really big on this because he's a medical practitioner who worked, you know, in the field of addictions for many years. Anyway, just to finish with your question there, this is, I think I said before, but this is the part, this you, this self has been hiding away, and they need the anchor, you know, the fragmented bits of themselves which have been protective of the self for so long need somebody to direct and integrate them, because they're pretty damn capable. You know, they have been doing the work of keeping you safe for a very long time, and they don't want to let go of that. And so you need the skill and the strength to be able to do that for people.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, from my learning and understanding of codependency, if you have a therapist who's not got a strong sense of self, then there can be a unhealthy codependent dynamic that can evolve, where the client needs the therapist, and at some level the therapist needs the client, or at the very least feels this compulsion to try and rescue them. And so then you create this disempowering dynamic again, where the person's come to the therapist for help, and yet the therapist actually is not helping the person to feel empowered, but actually running the show for them or managing their emotions for them and all that.
Yes, that happens. And the other thing that you opened with, you know, counselors who are not very, I'm not sure the term you use, but if we're not very strong and integrated, what we tend to do is we tend to rely on our own intellect, which is generally our way of coping with things when we're not integrated. And if you're just working from an intellectual framework with people with great needs, it's going to fall short sooner or later.
It's a challenging one, especially I think for psychologists, because to become a qualified psychologist, you need to possess a very high level of intellectual and academic capacity. And so it's very, very hard. I haven't met many people that are highly intelligent and highly emotionally intelligent. And yes. I've met a few. And when you meet them, or I've heard a few that I've listened to on podcasts, and it just sticks out like a sore thumb. Because it's like, oh, this person's, you know, not just emotionally intelligent or not just intellectually intelligent. Because we tend to be so out of balance, you know. So then it's the cost of specialization, which I've talked about on this podcast before, but we tend to focus on developing one part of us and ignore the other.
Yes. The unfortunate thing, you probably discover this as well, that most people who end up with counselors have been referred to psychologists initially, and people often don't get what they want. Now, there are lots of really good psychologists out there, but they've made themselves good because their training is, as you say, fairly intellectual, and their only therapeutic or counseling model that they learn is cognitive behavior therapy. And there's certainly a role for cognitive behavior therapy, but it's pretty limited. And so if you're going to just keep working with that framework, you're not really going to meet people's holistic needs. And when I've taught in postgrad courses, people come for postgraduate work in counseling who did undergraduate work in psychology and didn't get what they needed. They felt they were going to be therapists and found that that actually didn't happen. However, lots of psychologists do short courses.
Yes. Observation that there's a lack of good quality psychologists, although they do exist, but I'm not sure I've come across one that's only purely been educated in psychology. It's like step one, 6 years of psychology study, then they get into kind of the nuts and bolts of the therapy, not to take away from what they learn, but it's just not hands-on. It's just not practical. It's so theoretical. And I think that theory is really, really important. The problem is when they get confused between theory and practice. And so they think, my dad's a career social worker. And he talks about regularly how he'll have young psychology student graduates turn up with a new job. And, you know, in the hierarchy, they're above him as a social worker. But he says, you know, these people just can't give any predictive value and they can't contribute much of real substance because they haven't had any firsthand experience. They might have the qualification. And you've got to feel for these people. You know, I've met a few over the years and they end up in these roles. They're able to get the job because the resume looks good.
Yeah.
And then they sit down and they have someone open up about their life and they're like, whoa, theory, but the practice is
maybe the word you were looking for, they can't give any of their humanity.
Yeah. That's
a little too black and white. I know it would be unfair to a lot of people. I'm about to go away to escape the winter here. And so with a few clients I've been either bringing them to an end or referring them on. And one of the people that I just rounded off with, who's on his own trajectory now, he'll be just fine. He, in our summing up, he said, you play a priestly role, which I found very interesting. I'm not a churchy person, but he actually articulated something that I was experiencing, which I hadn't quite found the words for yet, because I'm no longer in my head. When I'm working with complex PTSD people, I'm no longer in my head. I have to be so present with them and where they're at and be prepared to take the risk of guiding them on inner journeys, you know, for the type of integration they need. And it really does feel like holy work. I think that's why I like it so much. I'm at that stage of the game where that makes a whole lot of sense in my life.
Well, that's a huge difference. I mean, just from my experience of you and our friendship and stuff, you know, and even your career, you've done so much of the academic side of it that there's that irony that you're teaching it, but doing it and teaching it is so different compared to other other topics and areas that teaching and doing has a lot more crossover.
Yes. In fact, even in the years, all those years that I was working in academia, I've always had a small private practice. I used to say to people, I'm not really a therapist, I'm an educator, which I felt is true of me. You know, I have my own drive to understand things, and I love conveying that understanding. That's the essence of being a teacher. But I no longer feel that way. I feel like a therapist now, probably for the first time, in fact.
Yeah, so, you've definitely said that to me in the past. Yeah.
Oh, about being an educator?
Yeah.
Yeah. I shouldn't spread it too far, really, should I? Anyway, I'm over it now.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, well, that's great.
Yeah.
Well, we've been gone for a while now, and I feel like people feel a bit ripped off if we don't circle back around to the archetypes and develop a few more of those specific examples.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's up to you how much we go through it, because it's
let me at least cover, because we've really talked about the archetypes that unfold in our first 20 years stuff, and presumably everyone who listens to you will be able to relate to those, because we don't slough them off, we just integrate them with time. But people in midlife have quite different archetypes at work. So what they do is they come up in their time. They'll be volatile, so there is a profiling tool you can use for this, and that shows the volatility. They'll be volatile when they are biographically the archetypes that are emerging, and then our job is to wrestle with the forces behind those archetypes and bring them into balance so that they're workable in our lives. Mm-hmm. So then the next pair, and this is really the, you know, around the age of 20, the lover and the seeker start to unfold. And those are about developing the personality. Who am I is their question. And the seeker is the one that ventures out into the world to find out, who am I and how do I want to construct a personality, by trying on lots of different things, different cultures, different friendship groups, different jobs, and so on and so on. And the aim of the seeker is autonomy. Mm-hmm. The seeker can get lost in the externals if left to its own devices. And on the other hand is the lover. And the lover finds its heightened sense of self through union with another person, or through living out a particular passion. So artists, for example, would have the passion of the lover very high, whether they were in an intimate relationship or not.
I'm guessing mystics or particularly like devout religious people could fit into that too.
In terms of the sort of mystical wedding or, you know, the marriage.
I'm actually pulling from Richard Rohr's work. He talks about the power of great love to transform, and that can be love with the divine.
So yeah. I suspect that then we're talking about, so remember, we're talking about psychological forces here. I think that the highly integrated personality will then transcend our psychological forces. And that's when that kind of union with God, in the mystic sense, it would be called union with God. That's when that can take place. Or in the language of psychosynthesis, that, you know, that we have a transcendent or a transpersonal experience, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That the spark of the divine in us is at one with the collective mm-hmm. unconscious mm-hmm. or the divine mm-hmm. in the universe around us. So again, those two in balance, the real gift of the lover is this presence, you know, this warm heart presence. And so you can imagine the seeker is out exploring the world, and the lover is at home keeping the hearth warm. And we want the seeker to be able to come back home and to, you know, to embody the personality or the autonomy that it's been seeking. And then the next pair, the creator and destroyer. So we're kind of moving on to, you know, in midlife, we need midlife, whenever that is, right? Because it seems to have no beginning and no end anymore. But
yes,
but I know people at 35 wouldn't want to think they're in midlife. I'm not really sure biographically when the creator and destroyer archetypes begin to unfold, but certainly by 40. And what, so 40, by the way, midlife, I should say, is when Jung talks about, you know, this whole second half of life should be devoted towards unfolding the unconscious. Mm. And so the inner path starts in midlife. And, you know, the outer materialistic coming down to earth has been quite appropriate up until midlife, but it's no longer. It will be our undoing if we don't start going inward in midlife. Mm. And the creator and destroyer, it's the first notion that actually I shouldn't be holding on to things. So the creator continually recognizes the things in the world outside itself that are a part of its path or its destiny, if you will. I see something, it enlivens this part within me. It feels like enthusiasm and excitement, and I know that's for me and I need to go there. And so that's a great force, you know, this kindling in midlife. And the destroyer's job is to actually recognize what doesn't serve my development anymore, mm-hmm. and to be able to let it go. And whether that's, you know, too much clutter in my house or old baggage or old ideas or structures that hold me back.
Or relationships.
Exactly. Yeah. That is kind of the lifeblood of, you know, Freud and Erikson. They both talk about in later life, it's this battle between stagnation and generativity. I think the creator is the key to the generativity.
Mm.
And not everybody has a well-developed creator, but you can. In fact, the creative arts are a way of stimulating that. Mm. And then we have the return archetype. So the last four archetypes, and the difference with the return archetypes is while they're still developmental for us, the benefit of us taking on these new energies is it has an overflow effect, which is helpful for the environments that we're in.
Yep.
So for example, the next pair are called the magician and the ruler archetypes. The magician might be called the wizard, but what the magician has, a deep trust in the world and the processes of the world, and a knowledge that whatever's happening is for a reason. Mm-hmm. And so the magician, so this is a late in life archetype now, so it's quite conscious, hopefully quite conscious of what's going on in the world, but it will look at something that's unfolding and say, that's a very important lesson for that person. I'll just keep my eye on it. Whereas the ruler, on the other hand, is very capable. Responsibility is the big word for the ruler. It wants to bring order out of chaos. So when the ruler sees that, it will step in and take care of the situation. And you know, there's a time and a place for both of those things. So we want them both well developed in us. Too much ruler and not enough magician looks like control. Mm-hmm. Too much magician and not enough ruler looks like irresponsibility. Yeah, they just let things slide, can't be bothered. In fact, that when we talk about relationships, that's one thing that I think comes out in relationships. The magician's willingness to just let things be and the ruler's need to take control. So then the ruler sees the person who's manifesting the magician as lazy, and the person who's high in the magician looks at the other as a control freak. That's not uncommon, yes, in relationships.
It's not uncommon at all. Yeah, I see a lot of this in the couples, but I never connected it to the archetypes like that. So that's something I'm going to have to mull over. I know that when you did the profile with me, magician and ruler were both quite strong.
Right, good, yes.
I need to go back and review that. But I remember that I had a lot of the quote-unquote later life archetype stuff there. yeah. which, you know, on first glance could make me want to have some sort of pride or something. But I quickly realized that for the age I was at when I did it, and I can't remember now, I was early 30s, that there were some others that I'd sort of neglected or skipped over a little. And I feel like I'm going back and developing some of those energies. I like that idea of energies. Is that something you see much, a kind of out of order developmental process that's occurred?
Yeah, interesting that you should say that. I think people who are attracted to this work and people who pay for a profile are people who are into self-development and want to understand themselves. So yes, those, you know, the wisdom that comes with the later in life archetypes tend to be quite strong in a lot of people who do profiles. Yeah. And in the workshops too. And in fact, it goes even further than that. The magician is often high because the magician is our inner philosopher. So if people were really just into making sure the world around, you know, exercising their capabilities and their responsibility, they might not be the type also to do self-development work. It's the magician takes the inner path there, really. But the other ones that you talk, the other ones that I haven't mentioned yet are the jester and the sage. And you know, this is the last pairing in life, and it's kind of our summation of, you know, what is most important about life. And the jester would say the most important thing about life is enjoying life, and there's a great deal of wisdom in that. The sage, on the other hand, emphasizes truth and transparency and so on. And the sage is very serious, and the jester, you know, there's a lot of levity that goes with the jester by definition. And so a lot of people who do, for example, my workshops will also be quite high in the sage. They'll look down their nose at the jester and think of it as being quite frivolous.
Yep.
Whereas it's not, you know, those two things in balance are great. So,
absolutely. I've definitely looked down my nose at the jester in the past. And now I'm kind of almost the opposite. When I come across that jester energy and someone around me, I realize the value of that. I was only talking to a couple yesterday about their partner who is more lighthearted and easygoing and all this, which is an issue, you know, this for them. And I'm saying, you know, talking about irresponsible. And I was saying, yeah, but the flip side is the fun loving, the easygoing, the enjoyable. I didn't self-disclose in that moment, but I'm like thinking like, yeah, I need to lighten up more. This is good. Yeah. We need the jester. And it concerns me the way in which the political correct culture is starting to have an impact on those eccentric jester-like characters on the fringes of society that I think we need. Those people who are a bit outrageous but make us smile, make us giggle. Yes. And of course, at the same time, bring in some of the sage through that jester. I never thought about that before, but I suppose, yeah, the jester is almost like a portal into some of that sage-like wisdom.
It is now. You know, the jester, of course, the jester of old was the one in the king's court, the only one who could speak truth to the king or queen. And, you know, the jesters in today's world really are those highly intelligent comedians, you know, Jimmy Fallon and, you know, people who just nail
Russell Brand,
right? Yeah, Russell Brand, exactly.
Yeah.
And, but there's certainly no lack of sage in them. You know, they're earnest. They're, you know, their aim is to get the truth out.
Yes.
But to tell it in a way that is, you know, has some levity. I was going to say also, you know, when you talk about a client like that, who's they're too sort of fun-loving for them.
Yeah,
you know, that again, that's probably exactly what attracted them to them in the first place, right?
I'm sure. Yeah. And I found myself talking about an old friend who was always losing things and breaking things and getting himself into all sorts of circumstances, and it would really stress me out. And then one day I was like looking at him going, hold on, I'm stressed on their behalf but they're not stressed. What do they get that I don't get? They've just done this silly thing that's cost them money, and yet they're not stressed.
Yeah.
And it was quite transformational to go, there's something they get that I don't get in my overly tight and controlled way of being. Yeah, so I think, and from an Enneagram perspective, I see that very much as like the Enneagram 7 energy, which is the partier, the person that always is up for a bit of fun and a bit of an adventure.
Yes, well, I'm an Enneagram 7, actually, and I'm much more sage than jester. Although somebody pointed out at the end of my last archetypes workshop, somebody said, I bet you you're quite high in the jester, because I enjoy teaching, you know, and when I have people for a whole weekend around a creative activity like these archetype workshops, you know, we have fun together. And somebody said, I bet you're quite high in the jester. My automatic response was, no, I've never been particularly high in the jester. But for that workshop, I had redone the profile myself because I hadn't done it for a couple of years. And after having assumed that was still true of me, I went back and I looked at my scores that I had just done days previously. And indeed, my jester was uncharacteristically high again. So I do get, you know, I'm a news junkie and I take the world too seriously. Yeah. But another, you know, when you talk about couples, you know, all of those dynamics that we have inside ourselves. So, you know, my magician and ruler at war with one another, as they can be, you know, they're also obvious in our external worlds. That's the nature of the inner world, that we can see it around us if we know how to look at it. So there's lots to be learned just understanding the archetypes. There's lots to be learned about ourselves and others around us. And through the dynamics with others around us, we can refer back to ourselves again. You know, why does somebody who's so bloody philosophical push my buttons all the time? You know, it's because I want to take control. I want everything to be predictable and under wraps.
Yeah. And that's so central to my work with couples. And it's an evolving process, but to improve my skills in this area. But a lot of it is to try and help people reframe this thing that's a pain in the bum is also, you know, one of the biggest gifts. If you just look at it pragmatically, you know, you want someone who's fun and you want someone who's a bit more serious and a bit more organized, and, you know, they've got a prophetic message to give to one another. And I think that's the, you know, the never-ending journey for those of us that are in long-term relationships, how to see our partner's quote-unquote flaws and go, hold on, there's another side to this coin. It's not really a flaw. I see it similar to you, like it's a continuum. It's like, well, you know, usually you don't get spontaneous and creative in the same package as really orderly and organized. Sometimes you do, but usually it's like, yeah, okay, I'll take this. I won't, you know, and to then start to see, hey, I'm offering a gift to my partner who's not very organized or systematic. I'm offering the gift of structure. And in return, they're offering me the gift of a bit of levity or whatever.
Yeah.
It's fascinating. Is there anything else that you had thought of saying or to round off the archetype stuff that we're missing?
This profiling tool, for example, in the end, your 12 archetypes are rated from up to 30. 30 out of 30 is as high as it can get. And through the strength of the archetype, you can talk about lead archetypes. And people often really identify. You can also see the ones that are disowned in us. But lead archetypes are ones that people identify with. You know, they say, yes, that's what makes sense of life to me. And so that's very helpful sometimes. So, for example, I've done a whole lot of teachers, and teachers will almost always have a very high caregiver. And so whether it's, you know, I as I said before, when things are unfolding, they're volatile. So in our teenage years, it is the warrior and the caregiver that will be quite volatile. When the caregiver is still really high at 50, then you know they've either had a very late in life baby or they're in the caring professions.
And
so for teachers, they wouldn't have it any other way. You know, that helps people to really nail, yes, that's, you know, they might say that's my destiny. You know, I'm here to care for people, to work with people. Mm. And, you know, sometimes they might do that to their own detriment because their own goals might always be waylaid in favor of the needs of other people. So these are just the things you can highlight for people. And also if the caregiver is really high, it's worth considering and asking whether that might be a learned behavior or whether it's true for them. And a learned behavior looks like when you engage in that activity of nurturing, caring, etc., does that leave you exhausted or exhilarated? If it leaves you exhausted, it's a learned behavior, and you know, you want to minimize that. That can be quite enlightening for people as well who were stuck in particular ways of being.
I think that's a beautiful place to leave it. Yeah.
We'll leave it then.
Yeah. So thanks for coming on. Yeah, it's been really rich and quite different. Yeah. So I like being able to provide something that's of a bit of a different flavor. So
all right.
Thanks a lot.
Okay.